Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. Tonight's episode is a special broadcast of my conversation with poet, interviewer, radio host, and literary event organizer Paul E. Nelson. Over the past 26 years, Nelson has interviewed poetic luminaries such as Allen Ginsberg, Michael McClure, Anne Waldman, Eileen Miles, and many, many more. As host of a Whole Systems Public Affairs radio program, he also interviewed authors, activists, and spiritual leaders on a wide range of topics. He's recently published an anthology of his interviews titled American Prophets. Nelson is also the founder of SPLAB, the Seattle Poetics Lab, which organizes poetry readings and events in and around Seattle, as well as the Cascadia Poetry Festival. He's the author of several books of his own poetry and editor of multiple anthologies. He lives in the Rainier Beach neighborhood of Seattle and joined me in our studio here in Spokane. Paul, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for your time and interest.
So it's a difficult thing to do to prepare for an interview with a master interviewer. So maybe I'll just start with an obvious and somewhat selfish question as an interviewer. What do you think makes a good interview?
Preparation. I mean, if you're interviewing about a book, you read the whole book, you take notes. I would give you an example, but I don't think I have any in my bag, but I'll read something and then make a note in the margin and then go to the back and put the page. I write all over the books and, you know, read it. Prepare in a sacred way. One guest said after the interview, "I appreciate the sacred way with which you prepare for this interview." And no one had ever said that. And I thought, yeah, he's right. And I think that, bring out the best in people. And then once you've prepared to do a couple of hours with a person, get ready for a good hour, and then get ready to vamp, to improvise, mm-hmm. to follow a thread that you think is interesting, trusting your gut.
Yeah, you know, that for me sometimes is the most interesting part of an interview, is the part that's totally unexpected. You know, you go into an interview expecting to talk to the person about their area of expertise or, you know, the book that you've just read that they're on tour promoting or something like that. But sometimes my favorite moments, and this happens a lot in American Prophets, your book, you get into an area that's not their area of expertise, but you can tell it's an area of passion or just something that they have hit onto recently that they're fired up about. So, for example, you talk with Allen Ginsberg about polar ice caps and U.S. economic policy. And, you know, you could say, who cares what Allen Ginsberg thinks about what the Fed is doing or, you know, what about economics? He's not an economics professor. But are those moments something you're really striving for in an interview, to get to that sort of uncharted territory?
Well, I'm willing to trust the person, and I'm willing to trust the process. And I think those two things are very important. You understand that when you're writing, for instance, you're writing poetry, that the English language has a field of resonance. It has its own energy. And it was here before you or I. It will be here after you or I. So if you can tap into the intelligence of the English language itself, I think your poetry is going to have more depth. If you can tap into the collective unconscious or whatever you want to call it, the muse or whatever, Jack Spicer likened the poet to a radio that was tuned to a station that was based on Mars, for instance, you know. So you trust and are open enough to let the unexpected come through and have happy accidents.
And my other favorite part about reading your interviews in your book, American Prophets, is for me as a younger person, as a millennial, reading your interviews from the late 90s and early 2000s, which a lot of the interviews in the book take place in that time, you talk a lot about being sort of at the dawn of the information age and globalization. And you talk with, for example, scholar and author Gene Houston in 2000 about the idea of jump time, this acceleration of technology and connection that's happening around the turn of the century. And you talk with parenting expert Gloria
DiGaetano,
yeah, about television and the detrimental effects on children. And reading those interviews 20-ish years later, you can just see the arc of where that went to. Mm-hmm. You know, now we all have the internet in our pockets and people are no longer talking about spending too much time in front of a television. It's, you know, infants are bombarded by screens of all sizes. Mm-hmm. So my question is, how has that change in the cultural landscape made you look at these interviews in a different way, or how can we read them, you know, 20-ish years later with a different view?
Mm-hmm. Well, the prophets part is really illuminated by it. And in doing this workshop on the art of the interview, which I'll be doing at MSU Billings, and I did on Vancouver Island, and I did at Open Books, the All Poetry Bookstore in Seattle, I'm beginning to go back over these interviews and call some sound bites from it. And some, my sound bites are like 2 or 3 or 5 minutes long, which is not a sound bite. And the one, so if you go to my website, paulenelson.com, and go under the interview tab, you'll see the art of the interview. And I'm housing them there because I'm doing that workshop and might as well put it there where I can find it. And Gloria talks about when children have too much screen time from an early age, what happens is it hyperactivates reptile function. And she's describing children in the interview, but now you listen to it and you think she could be describing the President of the United States of America. And it's frightening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the tone of the book is more, wow, this is the consciousness age. Here we are, and the internet's going to make it happen.
Yeah.
And the darkness of all that, we had no idea. We had no idea about data mining and Cambridge Analytica and monopolies, many of them. And so it's, you know, for those who know how to use the internet, it's an incredible tool. And for most people, it's like a joke. Some person told me, a guy goes time traveling from 2019, 30 years into the past, and they find out and they say, well, what was it like, you know, in 2019? And he says, oh man, the environment is bad. You know, we're having crazy floods and crazy hurricanes, and, you know, we're affecting the biosphere, and all traffic is just nasty. Oh, you know, but I do have this device in my pocket with which I have access to all the information in the history of humankind. And the guy's eyes get real big, and he's like, wow, what do you do with it? And he says, well, I argue with strangers and look at videos of cats.
Right. This is Chris Messini for The Bookshelf, and I'm talking this episode with Paul E. Nelson, poet, interviewer, and literary events organizer from Seattle. I do want to talk a little bit about poetry. Mm-hmm. You've interviewed a lot of poets, and you're a poet yourself. And when I interview poets and writers in general and artists, I frequently like to ask some version of the question, what is it for, or why this particular art form? You know, if it's a visual artist, why were you drawn to sculpture versus painting, or, you know, why poetry versus fiction? And I think some version of that question comes up in a lot of your interviews as well. And my favorite one from your book, American Prophets, that I found was Allen Ginsberg answers that question. He says, poetry is catching yourself thinking and writing it down. So sort of becoming aware of the process of your own mind. He says, so the function of poetry, I think, is to present a candid view of the actual mind with all of its contradictions and all of its compassion for itself and for others caught in the same boat of meat.
And don't you love that? That's boat of meat. I love it.
It's about the best answer I've heard to that question. So I want to pose that same question to you, and you can't just paraphrase Ginsberg.
I can't do that. Yeah.
But so what is it about poetry that you came to poetry relatively late in life? Mm-hmm. And so what was it about it that made you decide, yeah, this is it. This is my art form.
Mm-hmm. Well, I started reading bedtime stories to my daughter, Rebecca, who's now 27 and living just about 28 and living in Brooklyn and writing for the Washington Post magazine and other, you know, internationally known publications. And I would read her bedtime stories. And, you know, there's only so many times you could read The Hungry Caterpillar. I'll just say that. No disrespect. But I started reading her poems, and then I started reading her literature. And, you know, I started I started getting interested in. I started writing it myself. Then I interviewed Ginsberg, and you know, he would look at me, and there was such he was looking for a glimmer of recognition and saw little, I'm sure. And I said, I have to know something about American poetry, so I have to get to work on this. And then the next year, I interviewed Michael McClure, and that was having my head blown apart, reading his book, Three Poems, with the poem Dolphin Skull at 5,300 feet in the Olympic National Park, just up from Appleton Pass, overlooking the Boulder Creek watershed, and reading the words, more alive than I ought to be, and think, I think I know what he's talking about. And so it was where the words on the page collided with my reality. And it was like, you know, I get chills just thinking about that experience. And I've memorized large swaths of that poem and have gotten to know McClure. I've written the introduction to two of his books since then. And William Carlos Williams said that I write poems to figure out what I think. And that's because if you do it right, you're tapped into a source larger than yourself. So you can learn by doing that. And, you know, that's, to me, it's the most fulfilling way of figuring out what I think by being in that poem moment and writing it down. And as the great Canadian poet George Bowring said, you know, if you listen really hard when you're composing, quit your usual yapping and listen as hard as you can, you will have a happy experience when you get to be the first reader of the poem, which, you know, conventional wisdom would say, no, you are the poet, you're the author of that. But he says you get to be the first reader. So yes, you wrote it down, but you're reading it as if you're tapped into some entity much larger, much more intelligent, and much more eloquent than yourself. So that kind of kick comes when you write, you know, spontaneously, as McClure talked in the interview, when you use the projective verse way of dealing with it. And that's been said many, many different ways. Denise Levertov called it organic poetry. Robin Blazer and Jack Spicer called it the practice of outside. It's called the received poem. It's called...
Surrealists called it automatic writing.
Yeah. And then you have a more American version of that, semi-automatic writing, as Charlie Burks once put it. So yeah, it's and, you know, it's a lot like jazz. It's improvisation and it's fun.
Well, since we're on talking about your own writing process and poems, willing to read something. This is from your forthcoming book, Pig War and Other
Songs of Cascadia.
Other Songs of Cascadia.
Yeah, it looks like we're going to append the Pig War part onto my first book of poems, which came out just about 10 years ago, called A Time Before Slaughter, which was the original name of Auburn, Washington, named after Lieutenant William Alloway Slaughter. This is from another series, too, called Haibun de la Serna. So it takes the Japanese haibun form, which is dense prose poetry mixed with a haiku-like moment. And the haiku-like moment is at the end of this, after several five paragraphs. And this is a real Seattle poem. And Haibun de la Serna, because every haibun in this series of 99, some of which are in this Pig War manuscript, they all have an epigraph from Ramon Gomez de la Serna, who was a contemporary of Salvador Dali. And this one is, his good day was always overcast. Polonia Tomentosa, number 86, his good day was always overcast, Ramon Gomez de la Serna. And yes, he was from Seattle. And yes, the sun was shining that particular Friday in the season of lilac blossoms and a full bloom empress tree, princess tree, Paulownia tomentosa, stolen from central and western China, but an invader here loving the lack of competition for what sun there is, shaping purple hanging bell blossoms and leaves in whirls of three. We sit under it, take photos, are there if we think about it, Lakewood Park. And by good day, he meant in Seattle, nice, courtesy, and not much else. We'll wait for your street crossing, we'll not honk. A city of the mind, a city of geeks, people here totally blow you off, the newcomers say in the Times. But not at the stop sign beyond the Empress tree, not at the four-way stop where you go, no, you go, no, you go, no, you go, and the guy from Chicago goes, knowing your MO, knowing driving the car is personality enshrined. and overhead's a helicopter chopping for dark-skinned shooting suspects. And here, the anti-capitalism May Day riots, only three businesses with busted windows. And here, a view of deep Elliott Bay Azul under snow-capped Olympics seeking a hearing. Good day. Always overcast. Always an undertone. Somewhere, the intimacy's obscured. Some know the names of dogs at the dog park, but not the ones the other side of the leash. Not the neighbor's name or wife, but their latte order or Wi-Fi signal and how much in their compost bin. Is it the weather? Topography? It is a social script that leads to alienation, but Emmett Watson didn't want you here anyway. And we can't make a left on Denny at 1:40 in the afternoon. And bike riders forego single file just to hack at you and your humongous carbon footprint. In Slaughter, I once saw a yard sign that simply said, "Vote no. Can whip it out for any election. Vote no. Democracy easy as yard signs and being against. Just put a line through it. Easy as stopping for one pedestrian, or take a pill, or cut it out, or the bombing starts in 5 minutes, or the settler prehension a century after the perimeter's secured." And yes, the sun shines that particular Friday, the season of late magnolia blossoms, of English heather, or Scotch broom petals sticking their heads out of leaves this side the highway, season of lilac blossoms and the full-bloom empress tree, princess tree, Paulownia tomentosa, stolen from Western China, but an invader here, like you and me.
That was my guest, Paul E. Nelson, reading from his book, Pig War and Other Songs of Cascadia. You're right. That's a very Seattle poem. I loved the moments of Seattle nice and everyone waiting for everyone to go at the stop signs. Yeah. It really reflects something about the ethos of Seattle, being hyper aware of your impact. And that could be socially, that could be environmentally. It can be paralyzing at times to live in that. So this brings us to the topic of Seattle, which I wanted to ask you about. So I grew up here in Spokane, but I lived in Seattle for about 6 years after college. And there was just immense change that happened in the time that I lived there. You, having lived there for 33 years, have seen even more. And you make a point in your bio of saying that you live in the Rainier Valley neighborhood, or Rainier Beach, I think you mm-hmm. designate. Mm-hmm. and I worked in that neighborhood, so I know the changes that have come to that neighborhood especially. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask specifically about what that means to the community of artists. So much money has come into Seattle, and the cost of living and the congestion. And so what, in your mind, has that done to the ability for artists, young artists especially, to live and work in Seattle? And where do you think the end game is of that, of this just continuing influx of money and new people?
Well, San Francisco is where it's going.
Yeah.
Where tech bros don't want to see homeless people, where there's not humanity for people at the margins. And Seattle's very aware of people at the margins of sexual orientation or ethnicity, and that's important. But people at the and also to some extent people at the margins, the financial margins. You know, George Lakey, in my interview with him, which is not in the book, but it's one that I conducted this year, and you can hear it at AmericanProfits.org, you know, he talks about how we learn from people in the margins. And Seattle, in addition to its passive aggression, which we didn't use the phrase, but I was waiting for either you to say that, for opportunity for me to stick that in addition to being a very passive-aggressive place, it's also a very neoliberal place. So we can say we're woke and yet do a lot of things that are very first world type problem type lifestyle things. So, you know, artists are moving. They're moving to Spokane. They're moving to other places. It's becoming untenable to have an artist lifestyle like it was when I moved to Seattle 30 years ago. I moved in 1988. And the money doesn't trickle down. This idea that came through the Reagan administration, that trickle-down economics, no, it's a It doesn't do that. And furthermore, I think a lot of the quote-unquote cultural institutions that do thrive is because they have a very capitalist model, and that's the way that arts funding, by and large, is based, that the bigger your budget, the more money you're going to get. So dedicating yourself to building a bureaucracy is how to get ahead in the arts world, and that's never been my interest. And so it's tough. You know, I think there needs to be a lot more artist housing. I think Art Space Incorporated, which has the Tashiro Kaplan building down in Pioneer Square and the Mount Baker Lofts right by the Transit Center and other buildings, those kind of efforts need to be multiplied by a factor of 10 to keep artists in town. And and not just that low-income housing should go to artists, but a good hunk of it should, because artists have a different effect on neighborhoods. They're 24/7 kind of people, and they change the tenor of a neighborhood. I'd love to see artist housing in Rainier Beach, and I think that with the elections in November, we have the potential to get someone elected to the Seattle City Council who understands that, unlike the current city council who's outgoing, who I think doesn't really care. But, you know, there are signs of hope. There's a strong socialist surge in Seattle, and that can be good in many ways. Not all the ways, but it can be good in many ways. So I'm hoping that it manifests in other good ways and that I continue to live and be able to run SPLAB there.
Yeah, so SPLAB was where I was going to go with this. One way that you're helping promote poetry and the arts in and have for many years is through SPLAB, the Seattle Poetics Lab. And you put on various readings and events, and including the Cascadia Poetry Festival, which you have coming up in May this year. Do you want to talk about that festival in particular? What's on the docket for this year at the Cascadia Poetry Festival?
Well, we're looking at the poster right here, and it's a big picture of Sam Hamill, photographed by Ian Boyden in the last few months of his life. And Sam founded Copper Canyon Press. And it's one of the top two or three poetry presses in the country, on the continent, maybe. So,
and it's located in Port Townsend.
And located in Port Townsend. Yeah, very, very Cascadian, I think. Sam founded Copper Canyon Press, started Poets Against the War. His book, Habitation, published by Lost Horse Press, which is right here.
Sandpoint.
In Sandpoint, Idaho. You know, translated Basho. He was very much a student of Zen. There's going to be a panel called Cascadian Zen. There's going to be a panel on translation as a political act. Bill O'Daly, who founded Copper Canyon Press with Sam Hamill, will be moderating that panel. Many other fine poets and artists will be part of it. And to get in is $25, which is crazy cheap to get to all the events. So CascadiaPoetryFestival.org. And, you know, I would encourage people to go to this one because I don't know how many more of these we can produce, because it's difficult to do this, especially when it's underfunded.
One maybe less resource intense and still fun event, it sounds like, that you help produce is the August Poetry Postcard Fest, which I also wanted to talk about because it sounds like such a fun idea. You challenge people to write a poem every day for the month of August, put it on a postcard, and then they mail it to somebody else on the list of people participating in this event. So how did that idea come about, and what has been the fruits of it, of the years you've done it so far?
13 years. This July will be 13 years. We made it easier for people by putting the call out on the 4th of July, and then, you know, you can get your list as soon as there's 32 people on your list. So if you sign up on the 4th, and get your list on the 5th and start writing poems on the 6th of July, you have 56 days.
Oh, so you can cheat a little bit, not have to write one every day.
Don't have to write one every day, which if you have a 7-year-old, it's hard to do. If you have a full-time job, it's hard to do. So, we call it the 56 Days of August, and that's the name of the anthology, 56 Days of August, which was a book that came out in 2017. And, you know, now people are making their cards. That's the new frontier. It's not just buy the cheap cards, pictures of the Space Needle or Pike Place Market or whatever, but to create your own cards and make collages and then maybe write about that or maybe not. Your hand's in it every day. At the end of it, you've got 31 poems, and hopefully you do it the way it's intended and you don't cheat. You don't cook it up in your notebook and then write it on the postcard, but you try to make it a very much a Zen practice. And by the end of the month, you learn that it's really not so bad to do it. And happy accidents come when you can trust that and you don't feel like you have to make a perfect poem every time. Or as the woman said to Robert Creeley, is that a real poem or did you just make that up?
And that brings me to maybe the last thing we have time to talk about, which is a daily practice that you've talked about, which is the American sentences. And this comes from an idea that Allen Ginsberg had of an American haiku. So his idea of an American sentence is like a haiku. It's 17 syllables, but it's a linear sentence, no line breaks. And you've said that you've written at least one every day for nearly 20 years. So maybe you could read an example, maybe today's or yesterday's or a recent day, and then talk about what that practice has done for your writing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it keeps your hand in it every day. You know, you see something interesting and you think, that might be a good poem. Well, I don't have time to write a poem. Well, you do if it's only 17 syllables. So I've written one a day since 2001. So this is 19 years of doing it. I was diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia on February 1st. And there's an aggressive form and a non-aggressive form. And if it's non-aggressive, they basically monitor it through blood draws every 3 months. And mine's non-aggressive, thankfully. Mm-hmm. And the scientific word for this dormant state is indolent. Mm-hmm. And so yesterday I wrote, finally, my lifelong commitment to indolence has paid off. So that's a fun way of dealing with, an issue that could be very serious. My grandmother died of leukemia. So, it's been a thing on my mind for a while. And then I, when I'm preparing for performances, I don't like to go through the book. I like to have some kind of rhyme and reason to be able to present these American sentences. I like to do them because they're short, many of them are accessible, and many of them are humorous. And so I have this interpersonal relationships compilation that I did for a series years ago called Cheap Wine and Poetry. Mm-hmm. So it's very much part
of Hugo House,
that's right. Yeah. So I have a few of that topic, and I'll read a few of those. February 9th, 2001, one small spat, and you reconstruct front room into bedroom in exile. November 8th, 2001, 3 days after the split, I revert to a diet of cake and meat. All true stories. And that relationship, as you could tell, didn't last. June 6th, 2002, from Jerusalem, in charred bus after suicide bomb, two corpses in one last embrace. June 12th, 02. Only thing wrong with love poems is that the poem outlasts the love. April 9th, 03. Maintenance man leaves a note, says, can't fix your faucet. Its threads are striped. And
a found poem.
A found poem, exactly. Yeah. And many of them are found poems, like the one from 2001, I think. I don't remember the date, but it's next to condom dispenser is written, this is the worst gum ever. I guess I'll leave it at that one.
That's the goodest place that I need to leave it, I think.
Guess.
My guest has been Paul E. Nelson, poet, interviewer, organizer of poetry and literary events. His recent book is American Prophets, a collection of interviews he's conducted over the past 20 plus years. And he also has a forthcoming book, Time Before Slaughter / Pig War. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
I appreciate your interest.